So we often think of the planet and the natural world as being perfect, that if humans weren't around, everything would just be perfect and be happening the way it's supposed to. And then once you throw humans in, everything gets messed up and we're wrecking everything. And there is some truth to that in a way. But I also, like in this paper, I'm trying to see humans as just as important part of the ecosystem as any other part. And that the universe experiencing itself through us and through planet Earth might also have its own shadow side. And so in the same way that a human in your subconscious, at least from some perspectives, you have sort of shadow material that you don't want to look at or that creates strange and destructive behavior, some of that might be going on at a universe level as well, and that we're part of the universe or the Earth trying to work through its own shadow material.
Hi, I'm Ricky DeRiz, and welcome to episode 36 of the Mind That Ego podcast. I'm joined by Bethany Butzer, a lecturer for the ALIF Trust MSc program in Consciousness, Spirituality and Transpersonal Psychology, and the assistant director of the ALIF Trust PhD program in Applied Transpersonal Psychology. She has an MA in Clinical Psychology and PhD in Social Psychology, spent 2 years as a postdoctoral research fellow at Harvard Medical School, and was a lecturer in the School of Psychology at the University of New York in Prague, where she lives. Her research includes yoga and mindfulness for youth, transpersonal psychology, synchronicity, parapsychology, and the subject of today's talk, eco-psychology. Our conversation gravitates around Bethany's paradigm-challenging paper, Humans as Midwives for the Earth's Dark Night of the Soul, a transpersonal eco-psychology perspective. The premise that global crises and destruction could be part of the Earth's evolution toward harmony is provocative and leads us to cover topics from animism, cosmic and planetary consciousness, the underlying symbolic and imaginal worlds, ecstatic re-enchantment with nature, the masculine-feminine rebalance, and much, much more. Maybe to begin and to kick off the conversation, we could start with a definition of transpersonal eco-psychology and how you would define that.
Sure, yeah. So, there's the field of eco-psychology, first of all, which focuses on the relationship between the human psyche and the natural world and the ways that we can connect with the natural world. And there's research, for example, suggesting that it's beneficial for us, for our well-being psychologically, to spend time in nature, to spend time in green spaces. There's the idea of forest bathing, for example. So all of that would fit under eco-psychology. And then when you add the transpersonal to it, what you're starting to get into is transpersonal is this idea of beyond ego or beyond self, that transpersonal. So how does our journey beyond self relate to the natural world and our place in the ecosystem and in the ecosystemic whole around us? So transpersonal eco-psychology focuses on human spiritual journey that is perhaps tied in some way to the natural world, to ecology, and perhaps even to the evolutionary process of planet Earth itself.
Yeah, that's, I appreciate that definition. And in your paper, you link that then to the dark night of the soul, because you also define that, and then we'll kind of riff off that, but just to give a definition also of that process.
Sure. Yeah, so the dark night of the soul, it originated within Christian contexts around this period of time that people sometimes describe going through when they feel as if God is absent. So even Mother Teresa, for example, went through a very extended period of the dark night of the soul where she didn't feel connected to God, at least in her own subjective experience, even though she was continuing to do work in the world that many would have seen as being godly, for example. And over time, you know, there's many people who still refer to the dark night of the soul in the Christian context, but it's also become secularized where it doesn't have to relate to any kind of spiritual or belief system, but this feeling that you are going through a deep period of psychological turmoil, but that ultimately results in transformation of some sort, personal transformation. And there's this idea that at the times when we most feel that God, for lack of a better word, is absent, are actually the times when God is most present. But what's happening for us is at such a deep or unconscious level that we don't feel supported and we feel very alone. But we are actually supported in some divine way that then leads to potentially radical transformation in our personal and external lives.
Yeah, I love that. That also the link between that and the planet and the idea of, I know you mentioned it in your paper, the idea of the planet of Earth having an unconscious element, almost like a symbolic archetypal element. How would you link those two together? How was that bridge between for an individual going through the dark night of the soul and that becoming a transformative process to the Earth? How would you bridge those two together?
Well, in the paper, in a way, I guess I refer to it as humans midwifing the Earth's dark night. And so we are actually part of creating, unfortunately, in a way, but creating psychological turmoil for the Earth. Because, like in the paper, I talk about how there's research suggesting that psychological turmoil is a potent trigger for spiritual awakening. And so there's this idea that perhaps, for whatever reason that is beyond our understanding, the Earth actually needs to go through a crisis point for its own evolution, and that humans are actually occupying their niche in the ecosystem by creating this turmoil for planet Earth, even though we understandably, many of us see it as wrong, as destructive, that we're over-consuming. But in the paper, I try to present perhaps a little bit of a counterpoint to that maybe we're actually doing what we're supposed to be doing, even though it's difficult for everyone involved, including the Earth.
Yeah. And it is, and I know you say this as well, like it's a provocative idea to imply that, I mean, you just take a look around and see what's going on the planet, the amount of destruction, what we might call insanity on a mass scale, to imply that could be part of transformation is provocative, but at the same time, I really like how you note that there's almost that moral paradox. In terms of our human understanding, like you don't want to abandon morals and say, well, this is just happening anyway, it's beyond us. But this transformation is something we engage in, I guess, to different degrees of consciousness. Like some of us may have an awareness of what our role is, others might be acting completely unconsciously. None of us have got the full picture, I'm sure, but that there is a bigger picture at play, that there is something. An overarching element of transformation, even though up close and personal to the world and the various crises, it can be almost impossible to see that at times.
Yeah, well, and I think that it is hard to see that because we are engaged with the unknown, where this is a process that is perhaps beyond our understanding. And so we don't know why or to what extent or how long this ecological disruption might actually go on for, or what its ultimate purpose might be. But there is this idea of kind of letting go of that attachment that we know what's right. We know what's right for the environment. And that if we just put it into a mathematical equation about carbon footprints, then we'll figure it all out and we can fix things. The author Charles Eisenstein, he writes about this idea of trying to address climate change through current models of math and science and how. Yes, we need to do this. It's good to explore that as one option, but that not everything can be reduced to math, and reduced to some formula or algorithm that we follow in order to save the planet. And so this is a provocative idea in this paper because I'm suggesting that, sure, we can use math sometimes, but we also perhaps need to go beyond that into more intuitive, not knowing types of aspects. And I really had trouble publishing this paper because of the provocative idea. It took years to actually get it published. I wrote it four or five years ago now.
Okay.
But the peer review process took quite a long time. And I think it's perhaps because I'm suggesting this more, you could say, feminine, intuitive way of approaching the way that we relate to the planet.
Yeah, you include that quote about around, okay, I'm going to paraphrase, but we hope it's the darkness of the womb, not the darkness of the tomb. Like there's this, that the darkness is a renewal process rather than like a death, be that symbolic, or actually at the end of the planet, which is, you know, apocalyptic and something that naturally, you know, creates a visceral response. It's understandable to have that visceral response. I wonder, was it written actually? I wonder with the timing. Did you write this before COVID, or was it around the time?
It
If
was
it took,
just before COVID. Yeah, I
yeah.
believe I wrote it in 2019. My original like draft at was at that
Right,
point.
yeah.
Yeah.
So that was like just ahead of the curve, really, because I feel that COVID, however you know, you view the situation from whatever, you know, whatever angle you look at that. That really amplified this idea of crisis and the way that these different systems work together, the way that people work together, almost amplified the fragility, the cracks in the foundation of society, and that crumbling process has never been more evident. I feel that there's, you know, this term, the post-truth society. It's almost like these old structures are really struggling to maintain. Whilst there is, like you say, there's an unknown process in what we're experiencing. I wonder, could you talk to that in terms of the symbolic element? And I know, because this is the, I forgot to say this at the beginning, but your third appearance on the podcast, so you're the first person that I've invited on 3 times. And last time, because we had the talk on synchronicity, and the last was on Plato's theory of form. I see there seems to be some kind of link, and I wonder if you could talk to that, the idea of underlying form and this process.
And I think that so one of the reasons why, as you're saying, this topic is provocative is because it creates this visceral kind of reaction because we are attached to the world of form. We are attached to our bodies, our sense of self, the world around us, our friends, our families. And we're those of us who are in love with nature are very attached to the natural world too. Like I want to cry every time I see a tree get cut down, or I have a visceral reaction to the natural world as well. And so to think that we as a human species are destroying this world is really challenging because of how attached we are to it. And so what I brought up in the paper as one option, it may or may not be correct, but there are some theories out there suggesting that the matter that we see around us, including the natural world, is symbolic of something deeper. Some theories suggest that it's an interface, that the natural world is sort of an interface, and that there's something deeper behind it that our human sense capacities can't perceive, at least just under our normal circumstances. And there's the whole field of imaginal ecology as well, which suggests that there's something deeper going on or symbolic within the natural world. And of course, none of us know what this deeper symbolic aspect is. But to just give a more concrete example, I think in the paper I raise the idea of Donald Hoffman's theory of conscious agents. And his idea is that this interface around us is kind of like our computer interface. Like when I look at my computer right now, there's folders there. But those folders aren't actual physical folders. And they're symbolic of what's underneath, which are the circuits and the electricity and what's happening underneath. But cognitively, I don't know what all that is. And so it's just easier for me to click on a folder and open a file. Now, I don't know. I've sort of played around with this myself. I don't know what this underlying symbolic aspect might be. It could be archetypal in the way that Jung has described these sort of deeper archetypes. Some have described it as very simply as information, that it's just It's in the same way that ones and zeros make up the information, the binary information of our computer, that there's some sort of underlying information. Some describe it as consciousness, that it's some universal mind that's behind this interface. It could be something else. You can think of any kind of thing that's symbolic of something else. And what are those things? And I don't know, it's another aspect of the unknown.
I also like that approach of not knowing, not knowing, not trying to fully define the unknowable, because it is in its own, in the qualities of that, it's just a template, isn't it, to try and describe. With this, because there clearly is that archetypal element of death, and I know you mentioned this in the paper, and the link between the psycho-spiritual, like possibly physical death, but also the psycho-spiritual process of death and renewal, and how that could actually be playing out. And one would imagine if that is playing out on a psycho-spiritual level, then there is almost that, like David Bohm calls the implicit order, some order behind the chaos and the crises that we experience. How would you define that? How would you define destruction and death? This is a light question.
Yeah,
Bethany,
just keep it
how would you define
light.
death and destruction? How would you define that in the context of this dark night of the soul and as a message of hope?
No, I think it's a good question because it relates as well to what you raised about me writing this paper right before the pandemic hit, because really the pandemic was a global near-death experience or a global close encounter with death. Unless you, I don't know, lived completely off grid and knew nothing about the last 4 years, most people at some point in the last 4 years were afraid for their health in some way. Even people who don't really believe in COVID or something, there's still it touches on something in you that you have to contemplate about your body and how it relates to the world. And these types of potential encounters with death really can put the zap on you, for lack of a better term, of really contemplating and questioning, like, what's important in life? How do I want to be? How do I want to behave? And I think that these deaths can operate at a variety of levels, so that there can be actual physical death. So our Earth, there might be the apocalypse. You know, our Earth might die. We might die. Our species might go extinct. That's a very real possibility. And then there's the smaller deaths, like the death of a self system or the death of a way of interacting with the earth. You know, again, to draw on Charles Eisenstein, he refers to it as a new and ancient story, a way of like that humans need to come into a new way of being with the earth. And that our old way of being perhaps needs to die in order for that new way of being to come forward. And then just to briefly go back to this attachment aspect that we were talking about a moment ago, there's this idea of also being open to the idea that this earth and us, our species, might actually need to die. And maybe there's something, some wild, awesome, amazing thing that's going to come after us that. You know, I just imagine if dinosaurs had been, you know, had the type of consciousness we had, and they would have been like, no, we're the best species. Like we rule over everything. Nothing will ever be better than us. Look how big we are. Look how strong we are. And then look, humans came around. So, you know, maybe there's something really cool and just cool is kind of a funny word, but just amazing that's going to come after us that we just don't know what it is, and could we be open to the idea of death as a way to usher in that kind of process?
And this is a really significant, for any individual, for anyone, like a significant moral, philosophical, existential question to hold when, like you mentioned, the grief that you feel seeing the destruction of nature, even on a small scale. The other day I was making coffee and I don't know if it was a reflection. I was feeling impatient and frustrated, and I was making coffee and I was actually struggling with the machine, but I was in just my own kind of tunnel vision. And then out of nowhere, a pigeon flew head first into the glass of the window, and it made such a bang. And then my initial was like, oh, did someone just throw something at the window? And then I just caught it flying off. And that initial shock was then followed by, I hope it's all right. Like that would have hurt. I hope that it's kind of survived that encounter with my window. And that example, I don't know why it comes to mind, but probably around, there is that immediacy and intimacy of connection to nature that feels like a direct conflict between being able to be okay with the bigger picture, like being able to be okay with this overarching destiny of the cosmos. I don't imagine that's something that's easily reconciled, but how would you go about reconciling that in order to make space for this kind of process?
In my own personal process, what I've come to start doing, and this may change over time, who knows, but when I get overwhelmed by ecological destruction or by any of the just terrible things that are going on in the world at any given point in time, I do what I can for where I can, basically. So I often try to bring my focus back inward and say, okay, where can I create peace and harmony within myself, within my own personal practices? Like, if I want peace in the world, I need to create peace in myself. If I want the natural world to continue to survive, I need to love and pay attention to that natural world in even the smallest ways in my individual life. So, as I mentioned in the paper, I'm just like anyone else, consuming all sorts of products, services, et cetera, that are probably not good for the earth. But I also, where I can, try to, like, I belong to a community supported agriculture group. And so every 2 weeks, I contribute to this local garden. And in, over the summer months, I get this little box of vegetables and fruits. And for me, that represents a microcosm of the larger macrocosm. And I trust that there is some way in which those effects are rippling out. So the idea that scale, like I try to not be so hyper-focused on the sense of scale, this idea that I'm too small, I'm not doing enough, this me belonging to this group is not going to make a difference. Instead, I try to focus on this is making a difference in ways that perhaps I don't even understand, perhaps at that symbolic level we were talking about, who knows? And then, as best I can, as like with any spiritual practice, I try to release my attachment to what I'm doing. So I give this, I do this, I belong to this group, I force myself to recycle even when I feel lazy and don't want to, and then I let it go. Of course, I don't always just let it go because it's not that easy, but that's the practice. That's the practice and the processes. I try to let it go and try to trust that there is a greater intelligence or understanding that I don't have to hold, that I don't have to be in charge all the time and in control of what happens to this planet. I might think I'm really smart as a human and that I know what's best for this planet, but that maybe I don't. And so I can just release it.
Yeah, I really like that description. And it does, it points to, like you mentioned, the symbolic, the unknown. There is a big part of a microcosm, or I guess it's a macrocosm on this kind of geopolitical scale, but the models, the infrastructure that we have, attempting to tackle the problem with the same tools. To some degree, even though there's clearly growing movements and kind of conscious movements around how to relate to planets, but to some degree, still using that same technology, those same tools, the same way of thinking, And the message I got from your paper as well is that transformation of inner consciousness could be almost like preemptively, like if there, you know, humanity was a system as part of that, as part of the ecosystem of the earth, in an evolution of consciousness, the awakening for an individual as part of the collective is a prelude to the kind of consciousness that is required for us to not only survive, but to thrive, like to actually bring in those new relationships and maybe that whole process. I mean, it's hard not to see that in the context of like the fine-tuning of the universe, you know, the idea of my last podcast conversation with Arabella Thais was about the omega, this omega point being outside of time, and like the idea of fate and destiny on that scale that you're also talking to, but we still have that agency. I think that's part of the challenge, to be conscious, like a conscious agent as part of a much bigger system that we just cannot comprehend, an intelligence that is far beyond our grasping almost.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's ideas from many different theories in spiritual and mystical traditions that humans are a vessel through which the universe is trying to experience itself. And so sometimes I try to think of it that way, that I'm this vessel, the universe is experiencing itself through me, and that the universe is also on its own journey. So we often think of the planet and the natural world as being perfect, that if humans weren't around, everything would just be perfect and be happening the way it's supposed to. And then once you throw humans in, everything gets messed up and we're wrecking everything. And there is some truth to that in a way. But I also, it, like in this paper, I'm trying to see humans as just as an important part of the ecosystem as any other part. And that the universe experiencing itself through us and through planet Earth might also have its own shadow side. And so, in the same way that a human in your subconscious, at least from some perspectives, you have sort of shadow material that you don't want to look at or that creates strange and destructive behavior, some of that might be going on at a universe level as well, and that we're part of the universe or the earth trying to work through its own shadow material, and that it's not going to be perfect at it. And it's our job to just try and go through this process in the best way that we can. And I mean, for some reason, I seem to be channeling Charles Eisenstein today, because this other aspect that he wrote recently that I really like is he talked about humans needing to shift as a species from treating the earth as a mother to treating the earth as a lover. And it's a different sort of framing, where the earth as mother is, you know, humans, we've been taking, taking, taking. The way that a child, an infant, would breastfeed, the infant isn't thinking about, is this going to run out, or am I doing this too much, or they just, it's just happening, and the parent provides as for as long as they can. And Eisenstein suggests that as a species, that's how we've been operating for thousands of years, and that we need to shift to this idea of earth as lover, where giving and receiving happen equally and both want to occur, and therefore both parties thrive because both are giving and receiving. I think that's all kind of wrapped up together in that way.
Yeah, such a astute way of, and a poetic way of describing that change relationship. And it does seem as well, yeah, I get that, like the overconsumption, if feeling into and sensing into connection doesn't have to be a way of outsourcing responsibility, but understanding like where is that interconnection sensed, intuited. And I guess with the to take that idea of the underlying symbolic, those messages, I actually do, I had a stage, I say during my awakening, but at a spell where I was extra sensitive to intuition, to vision, knowing. And I feel that as almost cyclical. And there are times where I feel more attuned and times where I don't. I don't today, just to be honest. I really don't today. Just I'm struggling. But yeah, sometimes I feel attuned. And the difficulty is that the rational conscious mind wants to understand languaging communication that is very, very difficult to understand with that apparatus. And one of those experiences for me was the only way to describe it was feeling the grief of the earth. And it felt like that. It actually, on a bodily level, on an emotional level, it felt like I was feeling the grief of the earth. And I wonder if we are in this lovership or this interconnection with, you say the cosmos, but on a smaller scale, the earth, those messages must come through, right? And on a way that we have to learn, could it be that the earth has created the ideal environment and conditions for us to form physically at least? That it also is sending messages as part of that collective to guide to guide the process on a wider kind of holistic level.
I would agree with that because really the inspiration for this paper actually came first from just my own personal experiences. It didn't come from any academic sources. It came from soul retrieval practices that I was engaging in with one of my teachers. And some of these practices involve trying to find or just reconnect with aspects of your soul or yourself that have been cut off from you for whatever reason over lifetimes, and kind of bringing those back in so that you start to feel more whole. In a way, it's kind of a Jungian type of perspective as well. And in those practices, I was often at retreat centers that were in beautiful natural settings, and so I was often outside and just enjoying the earth and I would experience, similar to what you're experiencing, this feeling of grief, like profound grief that the earth, of the earth, grief of the, from the earth. And at the same time, this feeling of like this wisdom of the earth also being like, it's okay. Like I am suffering like no other, and it's part of it. It's just all part of it. In the same way that you might see like a very wise elder, who has some kind of illness, and but they're somehow at peace with it, and you can just feel this wisdom from them that, I guess when I say at peace, I also mean they're struggling as well. It's both,
Yeah, I
right?
get
And
that.
so, yeah, this idea of the earth being complex, like grieving and being with it as part of its process at the same time.
It makes me think of, I think we spoke about this actually recently, the process of growth being one of increasing capacity to be with difficult emotions, discomfort. In whatever form that may be, rather than eradicating it. And I do find that for me personally, meditation, I use that as a kind of catch-all really, because I feel it has carryover into various practices. But the idea of grief, anger, whatever troubling emotion, being not the totality of experience, and that stillness, spaciousness, peaceful environment, atmosphere, awareness, whatever term you want to use, is actually greater than the suffering. And that's a big part of the spiritual breakdown and breakthrough and renewal, is that ability to be with that paradox and to be like, yeah, I am really struggling. I'm really struggling, but there is peace there is wisdom. It's almost like within that, there's the seed of knowing that it is part of transformation, that transformation is what the grief is for, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's put really well, that transformation is what the grief is for. I think that that's what the earth in it and or the cosmos in its infinite wisdom is wiser than us, so even better than us perhaps at holding its own grief, having a little bit of spaciousness or self-awareness around that grief to say, like, yeah, this is really hard and it's part of my transformational process, and I'm able to be with it. And I still, like, one of the other things I really experienced in these types of soul retrieval practices is this intense love that the earth and the cosmos has for us, like annoying little humans, as the annoying little children that we are as a species, even to the point of I've heard some people describe like gravity as a form of love. Like gravity is the earth holding us to her in a hug. And we don't feel that because we're not used to what it feels like to just be floating around without gravity. But we actually have this tethering to the earth through gravity, and that it's actually a, like I said, a loving type of relationship. And I think that it's actually like when I refer to earth as lover, I also mean that the earth is having to get its head around that as well. That like in the same way that a parent might eventually need to like stop breastfeeding or kind of however that process happens where you sort of the child starts to develop more and more independence, that the earth needs to kind of like detach from us a little bit in some sort of way and stop overfeeding us and overgiving to us. And that's part of her process as well.
Almost, I'm not keen on artificial intelligence, or I don't, something around that whole energy for me is off. But there's something in that with the fear. It's almost like a microcosm of that process where humans have created this technology that we suspect and fear one day may be more powerful than us. And there is a letting go process. And it's almost like the earth in creating the conditions, it's all starting to sound quite biblical as well, you know, the Garden of Eden, and this idea of creating the conditions for humans to thrive whilst witnessing an overshoot, really, in terms of our power, our capability, just this idea of man conquering nature. That is so, you know, on so many levels, that way of thinking is so flawed. Like, why do we have to feel the need to conquer nature? That is, it's like you mentioned, that sacred connection that can be felt, that love that can be felt. I use the word enchantment a lot to describe these states of bliss, really, in acknowledging that union, the union with nature. Why do we want to conquer that? You know, it's insane. And I know in the paper as well, like you do mention that fundamental insanity that are, and I really felt it when reading it, and as I'm about to say it, like just letting this land, how insane this is. We prioritize the economy over the planet. We prioritize the economy over the planet. Like, what are we doing? You know, it's that is insanity. And it's interesting as well. I'm with the emotion today and I can feel it. I was trying to kind of hold it back, but I can feel that also in the ether. You know, the idea that the Jungian model, and you mentioned this and talked to it, this idea of individuation being a struggle. Yeah, individuation being something that is not a straightforward process. It requires tension. It requires, you know, one would imagine the elemental tension of how the earth was even created in terms of my science. You might have to help me on the science, because you know, like the carbon life form and the idea of the formation of the solar system and the, you know, the Big Bang and all that cool stuff that makes me sound intelligent. Like,
Yeah.
on a physical level, there's that tension required to create the conditions of life. And this earth, this planet has done that exceedingly well, more than many, well, any we can observe. And at the same time, it's like there is an emotional, psychological, spiritual mirror to that process. I'm kind of rambling. I hope there's something to pick up on
Yes,
that.
absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I feel you on that emotion. Like, it's absolutely ludicrous that we prioritize this consumption, these aspects of the economy over the earth, like over the limited natural resources that we have on this earth to continue overproducing. Like, it's not going to fly. It's just not, we can't keep consuming in the ways that we have been, and we can't keep populating the earth in the ways that we have been, and there's so many aspects to it, and I think that in some ways it's also about returning to, in some ways, what some humans, what perhaps ancient humans knew better than what we modern humans do. There's many indigenous cultures or ancient cultures that were much more in relationship with the earth than we are, and I think it's actually even challenging for us to understand because, like when I say us, I'm saying you and I don't know about others, but those in like the global north or more Western modern industrialized cultures weren't raised to actually see the earth as a being, as an actual being. They see it as an object. And there's a really great book called Braiding Sweetgrass, and it's by,
I read that, yeah.
yes. And she talks about how the author talks about how, and I might not get this entirely correct, but this is at least my remembering of it, that in her original language, which was an indigenous North American language, the grammar of it works in such a way that you wouldn't say the lake, like that is a lake or the lake. The grammar, you phrase it more like to be a lake. Like a lake is a being. It's not an object that you point towards. So you can't even say the lake. You say to be a lake. What is the lake's being today? What is it doing? And there was this animistic quality to nature, and humans related to that. And symbolically as well, a tree doing a certain thing or a lake doing a certain thing on a certain day was symbolic of something else. And we've lost a lot of that in modern culture, which has then caused us to create a lot of this just ridiculous overconsumption and destruction.
I really like that you use the example of braiding sweet grass and that animism. The fundamental part of my awakening was that realization, the crumbling of that objectification of the planet and of things into that realization of there's a fundamental aliveness behind all things. And I do experientially, like I get the on one hand, the idea of a universal cosmic consciousness that emanates because it is the foundation of all things, but also the idea of a lake having a spirit, trees having their own spirit, that animistic variation of things that are not objects, that they are alive in a way that we just struggle to define what alive is. That for me is also a huge part of this idea of re-enchantment. Like how do we re-enchant that relationship? I'm so just frustrated with this like the severance, the severance from that. But to play with the message in the paper, it has to be for a reason. That severance has also, in terms of the technological advancement, we're having this conversation now in from different countries. That's miraculous on so many levels that we can, I can sit here have a conversation with you, feel frustrated, share that whole process with the world. So I don't want to dismiss the technological advancements of that severance almost. Yeah, so it is like looking at what are the gifts, but then there clearly has to be a change. Like you say, it cannot go on. There has to be a shift, a re-enchantment process.
Yeah, and I think it's almost like any time we play with this idea of attachment and non-attachment, or this idea of in order to transcend the self, you need to have a self to begin with. And so it's like perhaps to re-enchant ourselves with nature, we had to get disenchanted so that we can reapproach it in a new and different way with the technologies that we have and the knowledge, the scientific knowledge we have. For example, can we, approach the earth a little bit differently than maybe our ancestors did, even though they were very connected? Maybe we can be connected in a whole new way when we re-enchant in some way. And I mean, I know the whole psychedelic Renaissance aspect gets into this idea. And I mean, I've experienced it myself. When I consume a psychedelic substance, the first thing to start getting animated is nature. I mean, the trees all have faces, and that, everybody, like, it's, it's, I think it's the more rational, whatever parts of us just blow it off. It's like, oh, well, it's a substance that was influencing you, and you're just making it all up, and the end. But there's also ideas out there that our brains operate as a filter that's filtering a larger consciousness, and that when we consume, it doesn't have to be about consuming substances. I mean, I've experienced this type of thing after retreats with no
Yeah,
substances at all,
same.
or ecstatic dance classes, or anything. Our filter opens up a little, and we can see, we can perceive that animism.
Yeah.
And actually, what I would add is, in the same way that, we experience animism in the people around us, the people we love, in the same way that if someone around us were to have ill health or to die, we would be sad in the same way that the tree with the face in it, if that tree gets cut down, I'd be very sad. And life goes on. And there's even evidence about consciousness persisting after death. So if the tree is symbolic of something else, then the symbol perhaps remains even when the tree itself is gone.
Oh, there are a lot of different threads, or branches, should I say, that wanna follow. I've had that experience, which would likely be defined as some form of psychosis in the conventional model, as well as experiences that definitely fit that model. But in terms of the altered perception, we hear a lot this idea of moving beyond the illusion of separation. And so often that can remain conceptual. That can be like, oh yeah, I'm not, we're connected, we're all connected, I'm connected to, spiritually to the earth. But the experience of what is seen, like how I feel as me, the idea of the, the observer and the observed, but the way I describe it, and it's something that hasn't been as active in my reality. I think probably because I'm in under a lot of emotional stress, just going through stuff in life that has dimmed that altered sense of perception. But hopefully it will come back soon. But when it's really present, there's just this sense, this knowing, this embodied perception of with trees, with the sky. I've been through. It seems to be thematic. Like I had a spell with trees, but then also with the sky, where I could be in that illusion of separation and just look up, and it would be as if the funnel of consciousness, like just this experience of unity, which is I find really hard to describe what whilst being an individual, but it's just this sense of I am the sky, I am the tree, whilst being individually me. That rhymed unintentionally.
Maybe you made a
I think I just
haiku,
did. Yeah, just channel that, keep channeling that. I'm onto something. But yeah, just that. I feel like a single dose of that can create a powerful enough shift in that way of relating that perhaps with the earth itself, with that intelligence and with the intelligence of the cosmos, will happen more for people as part of that messaging system. There also must be a reason why that illusion of separation has been so strong and why more people are awakening to experiences, feeling, sensing, perception of oneness and interconnection.
Yes, I mean, what you're describing is basically transpersonal eco-psychology because it's this idea of not just you go to the forest and you're like, this is beautiful and I love this, but you actually experience a transcendence of self in relation to it. You know, some, and for me, it happens often when looking at the stars, like the night sky, when I get this transcendence of my sense of self, of like, I am this sky, or just that there's something so much bigger than me going on. You know, I mean, there's even the whole field of like ecosexuality, which is the idea of like I was saying, this earth as lover, like it's more like it's not just about liking nature. It's, you know, it's this transpersonal aspect where you are going beyond that in some way, beyond your sense of self. And I agree with you. I think that that is part of this evolutionary process that humans and the earth are going through. And the more that humans experience these transcendent moments with the earth involved, the more that their behavior towards the earth starts to change, because it's impossible, not impossible, but it's really challenging to just to rape your lover, basically, you know, and that's in a way what we're kind of doing.
That's a powerful statement right there, isn't it? Because this topic's come up, I think that there are a lot of links between this conversation and the one I had with Arabella. Really interesting parallels. You know, this idea of a connection that has its own almost like erotic element or its own, I mean the common term really is the ecstatic connection to nature, the union with nature in a way that within myself I haven't arrived at a definition where I conflate it with sexuality. But almost like sexuality is part of that same energy. Whereas I think, you know, like Jung makes this distinction with the libido from Freud splitting off from actually our center of energy isn't sexuality necessarily, but there's a psychic spiritual energy. And my sense is that there is that element. The blissful, the ecstatic, the erotic with nature, which also makes me think of Aldous Huxley's Island, not Brave New World, that is an entirely different story. There was a way that he described Tantra and the tantric path that really just landed for me, and it was based around this culture on the island and how they'd had their spiritual utopia. And they were connected to their sexuality in a way that wasn't as we are in the West, to use a broad term, you know, more suppression around that. But it was based in tantric practice, so there was a sacred element to it as well. And he describes that, how could it not be relevant when we're essentially the product of like an orgasmic process of euphoria. So there is that away from such heavy conditioning around sexuality and also a severance of sexuality from the sacred, there is that, yeah, there is something in that for sure. That lovership, but also the erotic element, maybe distinct from sexuality, but definitely part of that whole part of the chakra system, I guess, of the relationship with the earth.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I often think of it in terms of eros, like you're saying, the erotic. So, like, sometimes when I use the term ecosexual, people are like, oh, so you're going out and like having sex with trees or something. It's like, no. I mean, maybe I think some people probably do, but that's fine. But it's about exactly what you're describing, connecting with the eros, like the life force energy that animates the cosmos, which animates the earth, which also animates us. And that idea that as humans, we can connect with the natural world and with the earth in that way and experience that sense of aliveness. And I think that's actually what people are often describing when, at a very just sort of basic level, they say, I like being in nature. Well, why do you like being in nature? What's it do for you? And there's this sort of feeling of, well, it makes me feel alive. And that's that eros, that life force energy that doesn't necessarily have to be sexual. But it's erotic. And I like that you use that example of, as human beings, we came from this orgasmic experience. And you can perhaps think of the Big Bang as that type of an experience,
Cross
So
the mind.
there's like something for us in that, in terms of an exploration around how we engage with the natural world and what we can give to it. So like, if you do feel a sense of eros or life force energy or aliveness from the earth, then as a lover, it's your job to provide that back to the earth. And how can you help the earth feel alive and regenerated and excited and all of those things? What can you do, even just in your own little microcosm of your personal life, to foster that type of a relationship?
Yes, beautifully put. There was a stage quite early on, and I always feel just crude using the term like my awakening, but it's good shorthand. But early on in that process, where there was that yearning to just feel alive in that context. And the way, and I'm not living this right now, to be honest. I'm a little in my own kind of hermitage, so I'm we'll get in nature more than I am. But this yearning and this receptivity and sensitivity to the most basic and yet most profound experiences, like just being outside when it rains, rather than this conditioned response, oh, it's raining, I'm gonna get wet, I've got to try and get out of this. Actually, just like, what if I go outside when it's raining, because it's raining, and I just feel the raindrops on my face, feel that connection, maybe take my shoes off if I'm feeling brave. And that, I think some people are more naturally attuned to that than I am. So for me, it just really felt like you say, it's different from being in nature and just like, oh yeah, I like being here is a good place to be, but to that more embodied harmony with the process of there's some alchemy in raindrops and skin. There's alchemy in wind and skin, to use that again. But that there are processes I think that we're not aware of. Reading, I have to try and find a link to this, but I read about a study that explored the scent that trees give off, that is part of the well-being that humans experience, is to do with receptors in the nose because of the particular, not a pheromone, but some particle that trees emanate is received, and we might not even know that we're smelling it, and that yet there's an increase in our well-being. Like these invisible, but that's still linked to the physical realms as well as the spiritual and the invisible in the sense of undetectable by any kind of modern technology. But yeah, there's a lot there around that, the simplicity of nature actually being the thing we need the most.
Yes, I mean, I completely relate to that. In my view, and of course, nothing applies to everyone, but I think that one of the main things that many of us can do to actually get out of a funk in a way is to do what you're talking about, like go and walk around in the rain, or like some of my most trans, almost all of my most transformational moments in life is when I let go of even just a little bit of this modern sort of, oh, I don't want to get wet, or especially the one like, oh, I don't want to get dirty. Like, try just like taking off your clothes and rolling around in mud, or like rubbing clay all over your body and then jumping in a lake. Like, it's such a primal and healing process to connect with the earth in that way. Even the most simple kind of act of either if you can take your shoes off, putting your bare feet on the earth, or in the winter, you know, those of us who get cold winter might not want to do that, but putting your hands, even if it's cold, like putting your hand on the ground or putting your hand in the snow, it can be really healing and grounding, to do that, because you're then connecting with that life force energy that we are.
And it's almost like there is a permeability on that physical domain. Like even with light, obviously separate from the earth, but responsible for it. But the idea of you don't have the same response to sunlight if you stay indoors, even if you've got a bright apartment and the wind, you've got windows, compared to actually being out, almost like those photons traveling to contact, that this way of relating on an enchanted level, and this is just on the physical plane as well. The idea of, like you say, just the term rewildling comes to mind, and I think, I want to say, is it Marion Woodman? I feel like there's a Jungian analyst who has had a big influence, and Clarissa, the Women Who Run with Wolves, is a good example of that. Very much part of the feminine path, it seems, to some degree, but absolutely essential. And if as well this, if this dark night, and my sense is that as well as the turmoil and the death and resurrection, there's a rebalancing of masculine and feminine. I think that's clear that there's an imbalance at the moment. I wonder if that is part of the Earth's process as well, to address that imbalance on spiritual and a physical way, the way that we relate from those more masculine tendencies of conquering nature. Is that unfair? Maybe that's unfair, but the idea of power versus receptivity and these different dynamics in that masculine feminine dance with nature.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that that's part of what I'm even proposing in the paper as well, is approaching our environmental and ecological situation from a more feminine perspective. So, first of all, yes, bringing in those more feminine principles of receptivity as opposed to domination or conquering, being receptive to what the other might have to share or to offer of their own volition. And making sure that that person is receptive before going into some sort of next step. And also just being in that unknown process is a very sort of more feminine, intuitive, you could see it more like a spiral as opposed to linear, like we are progressing towards some sort of end goal that's going to be success, but instead we are in a process, and sometimes we go backwards and sometimes we go forwards or up or down, and trusting what that process might be.
It makes me think of the I think it's called the end of history illusion. There's a philosopher whose name I can't remember, who argues that we've passed the point of man's, like you say, success, but whatever we were pursuing, we've reached that point and we've gone past it, and now we're in a decline. I don't know the concept well enough to say whether that's from a nihilistic kind of point of view, or whether it is from this, like as you said, that this sense of that trajectory, part of the crumbling is the realization that it's not going to happen. Not as we as we, or the collective egoic striving for technological excellence and the conquering of nature. Like, that's not going to work. That's actually not going to come into fruition, in terms of it requires a greater rebalancing, because it's so out of touch with nature. And that is something you mentioned in the paper as well, around the idea of being in harmony, and that part of this whole process is one to harmonize, even though there is occasionally violence in that process. There is destruction in that process. But if we do harmonize increasingly, that's going to, one would imagine, harmonize the earth as well.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that it's part of that, that process of harmonizing and trusting and doing what we can at our microcosmic level that then contributes to this process. Because I don't even like to refer to it as, again, as if we're on some linear journey that's supposed to get somewhere, because we don't even know, as you said, what the end point is. And it's very obvious that this kind of more capitalist, technological, patriarchal, all those different words, whatever you want to call it, strategy isn't working. And actually, as far as technology goes, things were supposed to be easier now. It was supposed to be that the robots had taken over all our jobs by now. We were just all relaxing. And I don't think anyone feels like technology has made things easier. In fact, I feel like we all actually have more on our plates because it is easier to do more and to access more. It's information overload. And how can we, like, a lot of this for me is also about how can we just return to a place where simply being is okay? And it's okay to just slow down and to not have to conquer anything and to actually just experience the rain on your skin or the wind, whatever it might be, and for that to just be enough.
Yeah, it's almost like a not, I use the word mundane in terms of like what Maslow might say, the miraculous in the mundane, in terms of like a mundane utopia. What kind of utopia has, collectively has capitalism been looking for? What kind of utopia is it easy to fall into the vision of, like as a conscious person or a spiritual person, and you dream up all these, these grandiose visions of what the new earth looks like, but maybe it is actually as mundane and profound and life shifting for where we are at, in terms of we can just enjoy being. We can just enjoy being. We've got permission. Society supports us in the enjoyment of being, and it's as simple and as beautiful as that.
Yeah, I think even Maslow referred to it as eupsychia, maybe. I might have that term wrong, but this idea of what humanity might look
Oh
like
yeah,
if
yeah.
everyone was self-actualized or self-actualizing. And it's that kind of idea, because Maslow referred to these maybe higher needs as being needs, not doing needs, but being. So this idea of, and I was just speaking to a friend about it the other day, to just be able to look out the window and see some birds, and that's it, and not feel like you have to be doing something, but you're allowed to just be there experiencing that moment. Because part really, from some of these perspectives, our ultimate purpose as humans is to give the universe the experience of itself through us. And so really our purpose from that level is just to be, is so the universe can have its experience. It's not for us to get a certain job or to have a certain amount of money or certain clothing or whatever you might imagine. It's actually just to be having our experience. And I would argue having these types of ecstatic experiences is particularly, I don't want to say anything's valued more or less than anything else, but there's just something I think really potent there for us in terms of our human exploration of this.
And whilst, because I'm just like, so I'm super skeptical all the time. And like for me, I think it's whilst being aware of the trap of conceptualizing the ecstatic to the degree I've just seen the impact of that, like in some communities that can just conceptualize the ecstasy, but that embodied truth in that those movements is, like you say, an incredibly powerful dynamic shift in. And that's what this is calling for, right? Like a shift in dynamic, which, as you point to, may be destiny anyway. It may be something that we're already called forth towards, whether we realize it or not.
Yeah, and I would agree with you. I think that there can be a real trap in this ecstasy as an up and out type of thing, and ecstasy as in, like, you have to have some wild self-transcendent experience that's just radical. But when I use the term ecstasy in that way, just looking up at the night sky to me is like an ecstatic experience, even though I'm not having like a really extreme mystical experience. But I think that there's something in experiencing the ecstatic, and maybe ecstatic isn't quite the right word, but like in relation to the article, I mean it even in terms of the dark night of the soul being a place of ecstasy or like intense embodied being in an experience.
Yeah, it's a really nice way of articulating it. It also, how are you doing for time, Bethany? I just want to check because
No, I'm good.
Ram Dass talks to this, and it's something I've sampled as well, like the paradox of actually being able to experience joy in contexts where joy feels like it should be at odds. Like he used it as the to describe his experiences working with the death, the dying, and essentially being with them on their deathbed whilst experiencing joy. And he was like, it sounds like such a conflict, like there's some kind of moral breakdown, but it's actually going back to that spaciousness around grief, around whatever emotions are there, almost like that. Again, the feminine path, like if you really invite in experience, you find that most of the fear is an illusion, and there is, you could say pleasure. I've definitely experienced, for me, grief, like actual grief, is not, I don't know, pleasurable doesn't feel like the right word, but there's an element to actual grief that is that catharsis. That is connecting. It connects me to myself, my emotionality, but there's also an expanse. And it's not the grief for me, it's a suppression of the grief that is actually the suffering. Like if I'm ignoring that and I feel constricted, that's when other feelings come in that are not pleasant. But the grief itself, almost any emotion, when invited and felt in its fullness without that judgment of the mind, can have that degree of spaciousness. And yeah, I guess pleasure, I don't know if that's the accurate way of describing it, but some these experiences, they're like watercolor paintings rather than like black or white. And it really can be that, for example, depression is almost like there's just a lot of black ink a lot of the time, despite all these different vibrancy of colors, whatever you're experiencing in life, a shift, an awakened shift can do that with joy. So that there's, I don't know, what color would joy be, like purple or whatever, but there's that color, that tone to even the most difficult experiences, almost.
Yeah, what comes to my mind when you're speaking there is emotions such as nostalgia or a feeling of bittersweetness. It's like nostalgia is a really good example of joy and kind of grief at the same time, where you just have this like sweet feeling in your heart for something that happened in the past that you're also grieving that isn't there anymore, but you can experience the sweetness at the same time, or this bittersweetness. Or I agree with you, there's times when if I just let myself go into the emotion of what I'm experiencing, even if it's a difficult emotion, and especially for me, it works with music, especially like if I just put on like a some sort of emotive type of music while I'm feeling this way, and I just let myself go into it, like you said, it can be cathartic, and it can be sort of pleasurable just to allow yourself to feel how you're feeling and not try and suppress it. And I think that men and women, to get to this masculine and feminine, have both in different ways been taught to suppress their emotions. The classic kind of male perspective is that, don't be a crybaby, don't be, you're not allowed to have emotion. And from the female perspective, it's, you're too much, you're being hysterical, don't show too much emotion, you need to simmer down, you need to calm down, why are you so sensitive, these types of things that drive me crazy. I think that when you actually are just allowed to feel how you're feeling, even if that means that you throw a temper tantrum and you scream and you, as long as you're not like physically assaulting anyone or hurting anybody, it can be very pleasurable to throw a temper tantrum or to have like a huge cry where you just like, ah. And it makes me think of what I wrote about in this article in a similar way of we think in our immense intelligence that the earth is just, like we were talking about before, only grieving, that the earth is just grieving and that the grieving is awful and it needs to stop. But what if the earth is going through a similar type of process where it feels kind of pleasurable to just let things out? The volcano erupts, the hurricane comes. Like maybe that feels kind of good, that sort of Kali-esque destruction.
That's a really nice way of looking at it. And as well, as an extension of that, like if there is a if we are, if mind, if emotion is a microcosm of this upscale, and the Earth would then scale up to solar systems, the sun, it would expand and expand to the cosmos. But the things we experience, particularly archetypally, can also be experienced by the Earth, by the cosmos. And I say that as a kind of preamble to this idea of the cosmic joke. Like, if I was to walk outside, go on a walk in the forest after this conversation, and a bird shits on my face, right? It's like maybe the Earth also has a sense of humor. And these things, like that bird flying into my window, hopefully it was fine. I'm not a psychopath. I hope it's all right. But there's that humor element to the way that it jolted me out of this narrow-minded frustration that I was in at that time. So maybe there is also that just various, like you say, it's not all tone, not all grief, but many different tones to almost like a the Earth's emotionality that is expressed in ways that we just see as abstract or kind of random, but there is actually an intelligence that is based in emotionality as well.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought in humor because I think it's something that we don't embody, think about, process, experience enough on the spiritual path. We get very serious on the spiritual path, and I think that most certainly the universe and the earth have a sense of humor. The trickster archetype has become just one of my favorites. The when, again, as us smart, intelligent humans that think we know it all, the second you think you have it all figured out, and that like it happens to me all the time where I'm hoping to go into nature and have this beautiful experience, and there's like a jackhammer doing construction in the local park, or this kind of thing. And it's like, I don't know why these things happen, but they do jolt us into sort of a certain awareness. They make us smile. They take us out of this overly serious intensity that we can often get into, especially those types of humans who worry about the environment and worry about themselves and their own development and the people they love and humanity. And we can get very serious, and it can be nice to just lift ourselves out of that a little bit every once in a while. And I really do think that the earth does express emotionality. Like I was saying to you in a previous conversation, after the mass shooting that happened in Prague earlier, a couple hours later that evening, it just started torrentially downpouring in the middle of December when it doesn't usually rain like that. And it was a thunderstorm, which we very rarely get in the winter months in Prague. And the thunder was so loud, and the rain was so intense. And for 3 days after, it just continued. And there was just something about that that felt like the earth was in some way reflecting, in its own way, the emotion of the humans involved.
I'm conscious of the time because I can feel I
Yes, we
want
could
to
go many
unpack. Yeah,
directions.
I don't know. Maybe this is we could pick this up again, you know, if we have another conversation, another recording. But it just is around this, the emotional aspect, and how I think we discussed this in the theory of form, but the old paradigm way of looking at weather metaphors for emotion would be you're human, you have an imagination, you have the ability to make correlations that don't really exist, but there's some kind of correlation between a storm and an emotional storm. Well done, you. You're a creative individual human on this planet. That's old paradigm thinking. My understanding, my sense around this is actually that the underlying archetypal pattern of what we call weather, because we are products of this environment, is also the underlying archetypal pattern of an emotional landscape. So that there is actually, you know, the idea of feeling the heaviness or the clouds lifting or feeling those emotional storms isn't just a metaphor used creatively, but is tapping into that underlying patternicity of expression or feeling that to take that further would then say the weather is a manifestation of that underlying form in the material.
Yeah, I'd agree with you. I think that it's. I used to think that, myths and metaphors were exactly what you said in the first, like, just, oh, this is just all us making up fancy things, and it's very poetic, and it's all very beautiful and fine. But over the last few years, I've developed a new appreciation for metaphor and symbolism and myth, and how it perhaps does represent something much deeper. It's not just us looking for imaginary associations. So yeah, it's definitely an interest of mine as well.
Well, we'll pick that up next time we talk. Bethany, it's been an absolute pleasure. Do you have anywhere you could point people for your work, any projects you're working on, places that people could find more about you?
So I guess the main one would be my website. So it's just bethanybutzer.com. And there I'm usually publishing. I have a research page where I usually, if I manage to keep it up to date, I put my most recent academic publications. And I used to write a blog, but I haven't been blogging much lately. It's more social media, so Instagram or Facebook. So my Instagram is at Bethany Butzer, and then the Facebook has a PhD on the end of my name. And I post little mini blog posts, or I post ideas about what I'm working on. I'm doing a lot of work on synchronicity with a few different projects there. So that's where I would be posting about those projects.
Bethany, thank you so much. I just really appreciate what you're doing in this world and the way that you're having the courage to, like you say, it wasn't easy getting this in a peer reviewed, but having the courage to pursue these different ways of thinking and interpreting the world. And I'm sure that it's going to have a huge, huge benefit, all around. So thank you for that.
Well, thanks, Ricky. Yeah, always a pleasure to speak with you. We
You
always have
too.
really interesting conversations. So, yeah, I look forward to speaking again.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Mind That Ego podcast. To stay up to date, you can join the Mind That Ego mailing list if you head to mindthatego.com/MFM You also get a copy of my book, Mindsets for Mindfulness, when you join. You can also follow Mind That Ego on Facebook and YouTube, where the podcasts are also displayed in video format, along with other inspired videos that I create. Or if Instagram is more your social media of choice, you can follow me at Ricky_DeRiz. That's DERISZ.